and it doesn't come into effect until 2002 when a requisite number of states sign onto it. In 2002, now we have the ICC. The ICC outstanding objectors, are you shocked? Who is not a member party of the ICC? Okay, Israel, but also? Us! The United States is not. In fact, the largest country that is a member of the ICC is Brazil. And three of the five permanent Security Council members are not part of the treaty at all. So imagine that, notwithstanding the fact that the Security Council is one of the three forms of establishing jurisdiction at the ICC. What does that mean? That means that there's three ways to get a case in front of the ICC. One of them is through, you know, the Office of the Prosecutor can decide. And one of them is that the Security Council can actually ask and transmit something to the ICC. But if that is a form of jurisdiction, and yet three, they have the authority to relay a case to the ICC, but three out of the five are not members of the ICC, you already know something's wrong. But now look at the ICC, look at the Rome Statute's actual stipulations, and I'll just give you a couple. Okay, one of them is this, what I was telling you, I think this is Article 13 on jurisdiction. But another one is also Article 17 on complementarity. And complementarity basically establishes that if a state's court system is adequate and can prosecute its own, it has the right of first jurisdiction. So that means that any country that wants to prosecute its own soldiers, say, for example, for their war crimes, that will trump the ICC authority to try that particular state. Who can make that argument and who can't? Very obvious and very clear. It's mostly going to be developing countries that can't make that argument for complementarity, and Western industrialized countries who can make that argument, and so on and so forth. But embedded in the ICC is what Kamari Clark would describe as the enshrinement of white supremacy or European superiority, which helps to explain why, since the ICC was established 22 years ago, that only Arab and African heads of state have been brought to the court, with the exception of Slobodan Milosevic. Palestine ruptures that. Palestine now becomes the litmus test.
You're listening to Noura Erekat on international law, real or fiction. This is independent alternative radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Palestine now becomes the litmus test of what the ICC will do, because now you have, since 2013, Palestinians wanting to establish, and Palestine wanting to establish its jurisdiction, wants to sign on to the treaty and does so in becomes recognized by the General Assembly as a state in 2012. Its first petition to sign on to the ICC is rejected because they're not a state. But then when they try again, now this shouldn't be controversial at all, because the General Assembly recognized that Palestine is a state and we don't need to have this. This isn't controversial anymore. It takes 6 years. 6 years, even though it shouldn't be controversial at all, between 2015 and 2021. For the ICC to finally recognize that the Palestinians can accede to the Rome Statute and be at the ICC and bring a case. That was Fatou Bensouda, the last prosecutor. She makes this decision and then still sends it to, you know, a broader panel to decide if her decision was right. She's no longer the prosecutor. Now we have Ahmed Akbar, who is the current prosecutor. At this point, we see early on, is not paying attention to the Palestinians who have put forth petitions. Try Israel for apartheid. Try Israel for war crimes. Try Israel for the settlements. Try Israel for torture. There are petitions on petitions being submitted that he's ignoring. And we see this politicization in the maldistribution of funding for how much money he allocates to the Palestine file versus how much money he's allocating to all other files. This obviously begins to change since October. But even since October, he travels to the region, does not go to Gaza. Does not make any conclusions, but is in Israel describing that Hamas certainly committed war crimes, right? So we already know, whatever we have said as scholars about the embedded, inherent inequality of these systems is manifesting before our eyes. And even most recently, when he did issue a request for arrest warrants, note two things about that request. Number one, it does not include the crime of genocide. It is almost exclusively and most strongly on the crime of starvation. But number two, there's a request for arrest warrants for two Israelis and for three Hamas leaders. So even in this moment, the law is going to do this thing of trying to do all sides, because what the law does in any context, even in your context here, I'm sure you know this, if any of you have been to court for civil disobedience or otherwise, it will drop the context out the bottom. There is no, it is a depoliticizing forum. There is no analysis of power in court or in litigation. Now it just becomes about specific rights, harms, and remedies. And in fact, it will be easier to prosecute Hamas than Israel because of the ipso facto nature of the weapons that have been used, which are not going to be subject to as much complication as Israel is going to create by saying that there's a fog of war and so on and so forth. Starvation will be different, or might be different. But all that to say, I guess what I'm trying to, you know, plant the seed for is don't hold your breath. There will be no court to save us, and certainly it won't be the ICC. Now, I say that, and yet I was part of one of the first teams that filed a petition in early November to the ICC that charged Israel with genocide, knowing full well that it was a site of unfairness, knowing full well that if they were ever going to bring a case, they would bring it against Hamas leadership. And by the way, Hamas leadership actually subjected themselves to the ICC's jurisdiction several years ago, when the Palestinians acceded to the statute. So this happens with their participation. I mean, there's no irony here. They're already being punished. Half sanctions applied to them are already designated as terrorist organizations. As far as they're concerned, you know, they are making this play. But I'm part of, even though I'm very critical of this forum and understand what it's doing, I was part of that first petition. Why? Why? Because here we are in the first month of this onslaught of unprecedented exterminationist violence with an unprecedented use of force, where within the first week on October 13th, when Israel ordered the mass evacuation of 1 million Palestinians from the north of Gaza to the south of the Wadi Gaza line, knowing full well that that meant death. It was displacement. The ill would not be able to move. It was a death sentence. That was before we saw Israelis shooting to kill Palestinians on the quote-unquote safe routes. It's why Raz Sigal, Holocaust genocide studies scholar, says and publishes his article saying that this is a textbook case of genocide. So we already knew. So by early November, we bring this petition, notwithstanding this risk, not because we think we're going to win at the ICC, but because we want to make the accusation. We want to make the accusation, and we want to make the accusation on world stages, so that the lawyer who brought this case in France is giving his interviews in French. And the people who are asking in English, I get to respond to and get to lay out the genocide argument. Movement lawyering. We weren't using the ICC. I wasn't certainly using the ICC petition and the intervention in order to prove that Israel was committing genocide, you know, in this forum. We know that. Regardless of what the court does, we know that. And the court isn't even prosecuting them for that. What does the ICC have jurisdiction over? Genocide is not a war crime. Genocide is an illegitimate form of combat. It's just illegitimate. And anyway, but the point is that's how we advance the argument in order to amplify what movement is doing. What about genocide? Like the Rome Statute, the Genocide Convention within it has embedded several limitations that absolve colonial powers of violence. For the first years of trying to negotiate the Genocide Convention, cultural genocide was included squarely. That would be tantamount to the destruction of a people. That destroying their language, their access to land, their history books, that destroying their archives, that going after their sources of food and their families and so on and so forth, that everything that we feel is tantamount to genocide, that removing them from their culture and their identity would also lead to their destruction. in the final analysis, that's not recognized as part of the Genocide Convention. We know in the convention itself, with the colonial powers, this is 1948. Jim Crow is alive and well here. Colonialism is robust. This is precisely how colonial powers are extracting land and labor and goods. So they are also creating this treaty in a way that is not going to harm them. It takes the United States a long time to actually sign the treaty because of their racial destruction or their destruction of a racial group in the United States. So already it's impeded. Moving fast forward, now we see a number of Western states also try to have a monopoly about what genocide is and isn't. And we see that very explicitly also in the way that the Genocide Convention makes a distinction between ethnic cleansing and genocide. So that you can ethnically cleanse a people, but you have not destroyed them. And we see that in the Bosnia versus Serbia case, where very explicit, I would say, and Bosnians say, Bosniak Muslims assert, is a genocidal campaign that features torture camps, that features sexual assault camps, that features the mass removal of people, that features starvation, that features mass killings, but that the court ultimately recognizes as not being genocide. Why? Because the Genocide Convention also makes it incredibly hard to prove genocide through the provision of specific intent. The convention has two parts. The first is that you have to demonstrate that there was a specific intent to destroy a people based on the racial, ethnical, national, religious identity. The second part is that you have to prove that the specific acts were committed in order to achieve that intent. So it's like a double intent. How do you prove intent? Well, according to the ICJ jurisprudence, the only ways to prove intent, there's only, you know, very narrow. It's very narrow. There's a high threshold. There's a gatekeeping function that in order to prove intent, there either has to be a smoking gun, like literally a blueprint that says our purpose is to destroy these people. Or if there is no blueprint, The other way to prove intent is to derive from the acts being committed. However, it stipulates that it must be derived from those acts that the only reason that those acts were committed were for destruction. What does that mean? That means if you starved, killed, removed for other purposes, say to ethnically cleanse, that that's not genocide and therefore there was no specific intent. We knew that too, as South Africa was preparing its petition. Why then would we support that anyway? Same movement, lawyering reasons. We want to win grounds. It's not to prove that we don't need a court to prove that they are committing genocide, but it is to win grounds. And there are two stages of evaluating genocide at the International Court of Justice. There's the preliminary stage, which is where you basically issue this petition for an injunctive relief. There's an emergency, we need this right now. And then there's the second stage that basically now is going to be on the merit stage. Where at the preliminary stage, the one that we all witnessed historically, the threshold is much lower. This intent, right, this idea of like proving this, overcoming this high threshold is not as high. It's far lower. And all we need to prove is that it's plausible. It's not a matter of fact. And then at the later stage of proceedings, which will come in some 4 to 6 years when it's probably too late, then the court decides on that other like higher threshold. And there very well, the court might decide against us. But then why bring that case knowing that full well is precisely for the reasons that we've seen, which is to mobilize, which is to agitate, which is to have this authority in order to be able to say that the principal judicial organ of the United Nations has said this, not just us in our millions. It's a tactic, and that tactic has not been enough to stop the genocide. And again, here we get into political will and enforcement. I am as equally disappointed that in the three opportunities that the ICJ has had in order to call for the cessation of all hostilities has failed to do so. Explicitly, I will also say that they did call for the cessation of hostilities by Russia against Ukraine, and that hasn't resulted in an outcome either. So either way, this would have turned out. It's not like genocide continues in Gaza because the ICJ didn't go far enough. No, political hurdles would still be there. It allowed for weapon sanctions, like ones that were placed against Israel by Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, and Colombia. It allowed countries to cut diplomatic ties with Israel, like Bolivia and Brazil. It allowed for the initiation of criminal cases under universal jurisdiction in other national courts, like lawsuits right now against dual citizens who went to fight within the Israeli army, as in Switzerland, France, the Netherlands, and Germany. And more than anything, above all, it allows us to continue to isolate the U.S. and Israel. They can do what they're doing, but they're doing just through brute force without any legitimacy. So the law is doing that work, even if it's not producing the outcome we desperately want to see. But that goes back to, it's not the law that's the problem. It was our expectation. The law can't do that. It doesn't do that. The law is power, and it will only serve movement to the extent that we are powerful. Which brings me to the last example that I mentioned, which was in the U.S. The Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case against Biden, Blinken, and Austin for violating the Genocide Convention and failing to prevent genocide. And here I just want to emphasize, genocide doesn't have to be complete to trigger the convention. The purpose of the convention is to prevent it, not to punish it. It punishes, but the purpose is to prevent. So there is an obligation to prevent. But suffice it to say that this case was brought on behalf of Palestinians who live in the United States, who have family in Gaza, who got to testify and tell their story, which is the greatest source, frankly, for any survivors, is to be able to tell your story to an audience, to have that ability to not be muzzled. They told their story. That story is on record in the Ninth Circuit forever. And in the outcome of that, the presiding judge actually found with the Palestinians and said that it's undeniable that this is genocide, and I cannot disagree with the ruling with this outcome. They actually make their case on the same day that the ICJ issued its ruling at the end of January. I think it was January 28th. And so he says, I cannot disagree with the outcome of the ICJ. And yet, because of U.S. constitutional law and the separation of powers that prohibits a branch of government from performing a function that's better suited for another branch of government. And here that means that the judiciary shall not impede the work of the executive branch in war making and foreign policy. That the court, even though it sided with the Palestinians, could not compel the executive branch to change course. And at the appellate level, again, it wasn't a rejection of genocide. The conclusion was that we don't have jurisdiction because of constitutional law to get around this. Obviously, there aren't arguments to be made. You can get around, but that was the outcome. And the outcome here, even in the loss, is this win, which is insufficient. So how can we use the law now? Again, at this point, we need to use the law where we can very creatively when it serves us. So where are opportunities where we can use it? I think that that's where we get really creative. One of the most important functions that the law is about to serve for us is a defensive function, as we are going to be, most of us, I imagine some of us already have been. Students certainly have been punished and prosecuted, but many of us also will be. Right now, there's two cases against the NSJP, National Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as the American Muslims for Palestine, alleging that they are in violation of material support for terrorism because of their support for Palestine and Palestinian resistance, which they're reading broadly as support for a designated terrorist organization. Absolutely shameful. The other way that I think that we can use the law also creatively is, frankly, to weaken our adversary, who has been able to basically throw shit at the wall and see if it sticks without any consequence. They can pursue all sorts of litigation against us with absolutely nothing to deter them from doing so, because there is no consequence. They can make things up about us and there's no consequence. Often they defame us, and defamation is the hardest suit to win because you actually have to prove material loss. And you have to prove that it was a direct connection. And defamation lawyers, unlike other lawyers, have to be paid up front and have to be paid a lot. So you have to have deep pockets. And so there is another opportunity for us here to think creatively, for the movement lawyers in the room to also think creatively about how is it that we create a deterrence function where we make bringing a lawsuit actually incredibly embarrassing or expensive in order to protect us more. So those are some examples. The other examples I would say, and I think, and I would encourage the ones I think I'm probably the most excited about seeing, are going to be continuing to pursue lawsuits of wrongful death and of war crimes against dual citizens who fought in this war and who come back and have total immunity and should be ashamed. And even in those cases, even if, you know, our courts and our political system is not favorable to our argument, I think that even bringing the lawsuit and making it clear and making that moral argument is going to be an opportunity as well. It's an opportunity. The law doesn't promise an outcome. It only promises a battle. And what can we do using that battle? How do we leverage that opportunity? And similarly, short of actually using these tribunals and courts and whatnot, the other thing that I would encourage us to do is to think about, you know, people's courts. People's courts, because this genocide will end. And the next frontier of the genocide will be a narrative battle of how it's remembered and how it's described. And so it's incredibly important to write your stories. It's incredibly important to transcribe and to archive and to record the stories, your stories, the stories you've witnessed, the stories of survivors, the stories of family. It's incredibly important then to also have people's tribunals where those stories are told in a public space and at a large scale where we're also influencing how that narrative is told so that we get to narrate history regardless of this outcome, because that is the next frontier. And that is also, however tangentially, also part of movement lawyering. But I do know that morality exceeds with whatever law does exist, even though for a lot of people, their religious law is their moral code, but those things aren't synonymous. And so what I will say though, in this moment, our move to understand this as a moral question is incredibly important, and that is what we should be emphasizing. I will also emphasize that as we move forward, we need to think about how many peoples have endured apocalypse before us. Indigenous peoples have endured apocalypse. Enslaved African peoples have endured apocalypse. Bosniak Muslims have endured apocalypse. Tamils in Sri Lanka have endured apocalypse. Worlds have been shattered. And our world, Palestinians, our world is shattered. We are in an apocalypse. And here the question is not merely this law, blah, blah, blah. We really are thinking about how do we recreate life after this moment? What does that look like? And here this is like inherently a moral question, a question of relationship, of duty, of responsibility. The one thing I want to pull on, and the last thing I'll say, is that if anything, what Zionist aggression has taught me over and over and over again is that victimhood is not a license to oppress, nor is it a license to harm. It's not up to you. And our victimhood is not a license. May it never be a license to vindicate what we see as wrong. May we always be led by a morality, which makes us, in fact, superior because we have held on to our humanity. Thank you.
You were just listening to Noura Erekat on international law, real or fiction. She spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. Noura Erekat is a human rights attorney, and she teaches at Rutgers University. She's the author of the award-winning book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Thomas Suarez, Medea Benjamin, Naomi Klein, Michael Parenti, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noura Erekat on International Law, Real or Fiction, and for her book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim McNulty and Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Patti Smith, Peaceable Kingdom.
Maybe one day we'll be strong enough to build it back again. Build the peaceable kingdom back again.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
this door's for locking. Have you got the key? In my leisure suite, hang up your jacket. Undo my back zip.
Come by night. I am a nurse, but I'm also a sister and a daughter. That's why I got the COVID-19 vaccine. It's effective against the spread of the virus and rigorously tested. If you have questions, find out more.
Visit aha.org/vaccine. A message from the American Hospital Association.
We don't think so. Are we looked at? Are we set back? Can we fake him? Emulate him? Hard now, features so fine, rouge and eyeliner, things I fancy, just like Nancy.
Love it, patronizing it, telling me what you think's fair. It's as if you really care, me more than most person. majority still of people who can